Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the leaders, clinicians, CEOs, founders that are changing the face of the healthcare industry in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners know, I am a CEO and founder myself of a business called PocDoc, and PocDoc are a great supporter of this show, so thank you to them for that. PocDoc's mission is to prevent cardiometabolic and renal diseases from crippling healthcare services, both in the UK and internationally. If you'd like to get more information on our healthy heart check, please go to pocdoc.co. That's P-O-C-D-O-C.co. It lets you, in effect, in 10 minutes using your smartphone, give yourself the equivalent of the NHS health check, including quantitative blood test results. So, as I always say at the beginning of the show, thank you very much for everyone listening live. It's brilliant to have you. It's brilliant to be on the UK Health Radio show, UK Health Radio channels. Johan and his team produce a fantastic set of content, not just our show, obviously. There are shows throughout the day that you should check out. And every single show, not just our show, is available on the UK Health Radio podcast channels. If you're listening to this show on the Health Tech Hour channels that are available on all the podcast channels as well, welcome. If you're looking at clips on YouTube, or if you're looking at the clips on my Instagram, which is at Steve Roost, welcome. Thanks a lot. Now, every month we get somewhere in the region of 300 to 400,000 streams a month at the moment across all the platforms. And that's down in large part because you guys show up and listen and comment and like and share. So thank you very much for all of that. Now, on to today's show. Today's show, we have a very special guest with a fantastic name, and I'm going to do my best not to mispronounce it, but I'm going to give him the full official title to begin with, and then we can jump into it. So we have Daniel Elias Martin-Herantz, who is the Chief Scientific Officer and co-founder of Hurdle Bio. So when Danny was at Cambridge, he focused on molecular mechanisms behind epigenetic aging in humans. So this idea of longevity. And after that, he went on to found a business called Chronomics, which was one of the earliest at-home distributed diagnostic lab testing providers, which then rebranded as Hurdle, with the broad mission to increase access to diagnostics, which is obviously a mission that's extremely close to my heart. And so it's brilliant to have Danny on the show. So Danny, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thanks so much, Steve, for having me. It's fantastic to be here. I'm doing good, and you did a great job pronouncing the name. So thanks.
Did I do okay?
Fantastic.
That's great. Is that four names? Is that common in Spain? It's a common situation to have four or more names.
Yeah. So two surnames always, one from the father, one from the mother, normally.
Is that right? Then, is that how it goes?
Yeah, that's normally how it goes. And then the middle name is kind of more optional. So yeah, in my case, I got one.
Do you know what? That's very sort of equal. If both mother and father have a surname. There may or may not have been some discussions recently, at the Roost Casa about the rights and wrongs of people changing their names. But that's a whole different show. We won't get into that.
Exactly.
So I want to begin. There's so much I want to talk to you about. And as you know, we talked about before the show, this is a broad church. We have listeners that are scientists. We have listeners that are not scientists. We have listeners that are clinicians. We have listeners that aren't clinicians. Same thing, founders, not founders, a whole range of everybody. So what I'd like to do just to begin with, because I personally find the very limited amount that I know about epigenetics, I find absolutely fascinating slash slightly mind-blowing. Okay, so why don't we just start with a basic description of like, what is epigenetics and why is it so exciting and potentially, well, not potentially, and just important? I stumbled over my words there. I'm sorry. Let's over to you, Danny.
Yeah, sounds good. So yeah, always super happy to talk about epigenetics. As you mentioned in the intro, it's very close to my interest since I was in Cambridge and even before that. And yes, it's not easy actually to define epigenetics properly. There are a lot of like discussions about exactly, you know, what is the definition for epigenetics. But I think for our listeners, you know, probably the best way to think about it is information that is essentially on top of our genetics and, you know, that regulates how our genes are turned on and off over time. And, you know, another way to, I guess, think about it is by comparing it actually with genetics, right? So I think people are more familiar with the concept of genetics. It's essentially, you know, the information that we inherit from our parents is, you know, fundamentally or like, you know, overall fixed since we're born. Obviously, there are, you know, examples where that's not the case, like in cancer with mutations, etc. But like overall, we can think about genetics as something that, you know, is fixed over our lifetimes. And, you know, it gives us predisposition to certain diseases, certain traits, like, you know, the color of your eyes, your height, etc. But overall, it doesn't change, right? So the question then is like, how can we have, you know, so many functions and cell types in our bodies that, you know, share the same core genetic information in our DNA, and yet they are able to adapt to the environment to perform, you know, so many different functions, etc. So that's where epigenetics comes in. So if you think about, for example, you know, a neuron, so like a brain cell versus, you know, a cell in your heart, they both have the same genetics, but what makes them so different and like be able to do complete different things in our bodies is the fact that they are able to turn on and off different sets of genes and therefore be able to perform in that way, right? Another example that I think is useful for people to start to conceptualize what epigenetics is essentially identical twins. So if you think about, you know, people that are born with the same kind of genetic material, then they go on and develop different health trajectories, right? So like identical twins can end up developing different types of diseases at different time. And all of that is determined by, you know, to a great extent, their lifestyle and environment, right? Because they have the same genetics, but they end up developing, you know, different health trajectories. And, you know, what we observe when we also measure identical twins over time is that their epigenetic profiles start to diverge over time, which is something that we call epigenetic drift. So overall, yeah, I guess
I love that phrase, epigenetic drift. That sounds so exciting. I love that. When did people start to notice? So presumably we discovered genes first, presumably. And then did somebody start to say, well, hold up a second, this doesn't quite track with what we're observing in some ways in the real world. So something else must be going on.
Yeah, so you're right that genes were discovered first. And there's been obviously like different, as I said, different definitions of what epigenetics is also across history, right? So epigenetics came, I guess, more into the light of research when people were looking into embryonic development, right? So we start our lives as a single cell with the genetic material, and then we go and develop into a, you know, multicellular organism with many, as we were discussing, many different types of organs, cell types, etc. So you know, the programs that allow to go from that kind of single cell to like an array of different types and billions of cells with different functions is done through epigenetics. So a lot of the initial research on epigenetics, before even we knew what was happening at the molecular level, right, before we understood the mechanisms, was it in the DNA, was it somewhere else, you know, we were already starting to see that there was, you know, this ability of an embryo to, you know, create different trajectories for cells. And, you know, some people are familiar with the term epigenetics. It was originally supposedly coined by Waddington. And, you know, he was talking about these different trajectories that the cells or epigenetic landscapes can go into. And then from there, obviously, there was a lot of research over decades. And, you know, with molecular biology tools, etc., we started to understand a bit more what were the specific types of epigenetic marks, the mechanisms, and so on.
So when did Waddington come up with the phrase, give or take?
Ooh, you're putting me on the spot.
Roughly, the nearest decade.
I think it was probably in the 30s, 40s, I want to
Oh
say.
wow. Oh, it's really
Yeah.
I oh wow. Okay.
Let
That's
me check it
way
for
earlier
you.
than I thought. That's way earlier than I thought you were going to
Yeah.
say.
But again, double check this, please. I don't want to
Yeah,
spread
look,
fake
okay.
news.
But so even in the 30s or 40s they understood that particularly at an embryonic stage, an embryo had the ability to effectively sort of almost like run a different operating system for different cell types that it wanted to develop from the same core gene stock. Is that right? Does that do those words make any sense that I
Yeah,
just said?
I think that's yeah, that's correct. And you know, ultimately, again, it took, as I said, many decades and many years to start to understand the mechanisms, but you know, the concept of being able to go, as you said, from a set of genes, a set of like a single cell to like a multicellular organism and have those cells go into different trajectories. You know, that was already like the concept was already there back then.
And what do you, what is it that's making those? Because you, I think you used the phrase tags, markers. Like, what is it, like a program, or like how do we think about it at the moment? What's the best explanation that we sort of currently have?
Yeah, I think you briefly mentioned it, like a program, et cetera. I think one interesting analogy is software, right? So, and there are other people also in the longevity space, I guess, using this analogy out there. So if you think about your genetics as the hardware, right, the blueprint that is kind of contains all the information that you need to make an organism and how that organism is going to be regulated, then epigenetics would be the software, which is kind of the program that runs different bits of the hardware and basically coordinates it to, you know, do what it needs to do. So during development, this is very much a program. So it is a, you know, there are very defined steps that need to happen. And, you know, there is some stochasticity in the process, but there's a lot of things that we can predict how it's going to play out, right? And it's a bit of a program. It's a bigger question what happens after we are born and even after, you know, we develop until we're as humans, maybe 18, 20. After then, you know, it's a big discussion in the aging field and the longevity field whether actually there is another program that is some sort of like aging program that is dealing, that's leading to us to, you know, increase the risk of developing different age-related diseases, or whether that's, for example, a remnant of the previous program, right? So there are some hypotheses around something that is called antagonistic pleiotropy, which is the idea that some genes that are helpful, you know, during development, then they become deleterious later in life. And because of the forces of natural selection, we still keep them, right? Because they're useful for reproduction, but they're not me
What
necessarily
was the
useful afterwards.
antagonistic what?
Pleiotropy.
Antagonistic pleiotropy.
Yeah,
Okay.
it's almost as difficult as pronouncing my name, Steve.
Yeah, that's definitely a new phrase for this show. Well, that's
Yeah.
a today's a new day, I think, for a lot of these things. So what where do you think, and this might not be the right way to think about it, but where does this sort of pro, because I think there's a general understanding that like some of the things about the way that you are come from your genes, right? You know, eye color, you know, that's like completely understood. And that's coded into the genes. But if there's a program that exists that then works on your cells at a cellular level and a molecular level, where does that program sort of live? Are you able to see it in the same way as you can isolate genes? Or where are we with it? How
Yeah.
philosophical is it versus, I guess, objective and empirical?
Yeah, it is objective and empirical. And you're right. I mean, there's still a lot of research that needs to go into understanding kind of that epigenetic program during development or like epigenetic changes during aging. And you know, there are, again, as I said at the beginning, different types of definitions of epigenetics. But there are two kind of archetypal, if you wish, types of you know, epigenetic marks. So these are things that you can, as you said, measure and quantify in molecules, right? And one of them is called DNA methylation, which is essentially a chemical modification attack that is attached to your DNA, the C letter in your DNA. And then the other kind of broad types of epigenetic marks are called histone modifications. So histones are, if you wish, they are proteins, they're kind of the clothes that cover your DNA and are able to like help it to pack inside your cells. And depending on kind of how you change the tags in those clothes, in those histones, you can open more up or close more the access to the DNA and the access to the genes. And that in turn kind of affects which genes are turned on and off. So we do understand quite a lot about you know, the different types of epigenetic marks, how they are regulated, but there's still a lot of work to do to fully understand it, because it's, as you can imagine, quite complex.
Absolutely. What's the big so what here, other than just understanding about this stuff, because we should understand and like the scientific principle of being curious? What do you believe are the big kind of holy moly? I was going to swear then, and my producer would be upset with me. The big kind of holy moly so what's of this? Where's this driving towards, or where could it be driving towards?
Yeah, so I think for me, a lot of the interest in this came in through the angle of aging and longevity. So when I was starting to do my PhD in Cambridge, it was at the time where some of the first epigenetic clocks, as you mentioned, or basically for our listeners, epigenetic clocks are one of the most accurate types of biomarkers that we have to quantify human aging. So if you think about human aging, it's a very complex phenotype, right? It's something that has a lot of, like, you know, interconnections between lifestyle factors, environment, genetics, and it changes over time, right? So, you know, it's a very, very complex phenotype. And what fascinated me is that, you know, there was starting to be a lot of research that used epigenetic data to be able to estimate very, very accurately the biological age of an individual, right? And so, you know, back then when I saw this, I was like blown away, right? Because it's like, how is it possible that with a single data type and using, you know, relatively simple machine learning techniques, we're able to see this, right? When if you try to use, you know, gene expression, or if you try to use other types of data, like it's not so simple, right? So that fascinated me. And, you know, from there, obviously, I was part of, like, you know, a research group working on understanding this molecular mechanisms of epigenetic clocks. And, you know, there was also a lot of, like, research being published by, you know, amazing researchers like Steve Horvath. And that basically blow up in the longevity community, right, during those times. And I think it has two kind of, like, trends. One is obviously applications in diagnostics, which, you know, I'm sure we will discuss today, and what it means for, like, aging research, et cetera, et cetera. But then there's another kind of fundamental question there, which is, you know, if epigenetics is so good at capturing this, and, you know, epigenetics is kind of the glue that links development with aging, you know, can we, you know, is there some fundamental mechanisms there that we can use to, like, tackle aging in humans? And I think that, to me, is, like, one of the most exciting areas. And there are, you know, a lot of people now working on basically rejuvenation, and, you know, how to leverage some of this kind of reprogramming technologies, epigenetic reprogramming technologies, to improve human health. So I think, to me, that is a very kind of interesting area of research that is happening right now.
That makes sense. So just, again, like, this idea of longevity obviously gets punted around quite a lot these days. You know, it's very popular. There's lots of different things about it. When you talk about longevity or improving human aging, what is your definition of that? Is it prevention? Is it around prevention of ill health? Is it around just lifespan extension? Or where do you fall on that sort of spectrum?
Yeah, so I think for me, obviously, the most important thing is extending the health span, right? And I'm sure, yeah, we can go into detail into this. But I think there needs to be a pretty big focus moving away from kind of reactive treatment of a single disease to preventative, like, proactive action towards multiple diseases. And I think the aging paradigm and the neuroscience paradigm is very helpful for this, because we're not talking about individual diseases. We're talking about kind of mechanisms that happen as we age that we can target, and that if we target, we're able to improve several diseases at the same time. So yeah, really happy to dive into that in more detail.
Great, we will do. So this has been an absolutely fascinating kickoff to the show. I'm hooked, I really am. So I've got about 100 different questions to ask. So we're gonna go for our first break now, first commercial break, and then we will be back with our guest, Danny Martin Herantz, who's the co-founder of Hurdle and an expert in the epigenetic longevity space. We'll be back after 2 minutes.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest, Danny Martin-Herantz, who is the co-founder of Hurdle and a thought leader in the epigenetic longevity space. So Danny, just before the break, we really delved pretty deep into what epigenetics is and why it matters. I'd like to now take a light, like the kind of the next step, which is what was your journey like changing that passion for this particular space and your incredible depth of really high level scientific clinical knowledge into a business proposition?
Yeah,
what was that journey like, the why, the how, you know, that, because that's pretty special.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I feel very privileged that, as you said, I had the opportunity to really, you know, take a lot of the things that I learned and, like, you know, get them closer to people, to patients. So yeah, I can tell you a bit about my journey. So I think you mentioned before, I was doing my PhD at the University of Cambridge in a place called the European Bioinformatics Institute. And I was doing this research on, you know, epigenetic clocks, using epigenetics to quantify human aging, to quantify biological age, understanding the mechanisms behind this. And back then I also was collaborating. So I was in the lab of Professor Dame Janet Thornton there, and I was collaborating with another lab from Professor Wolf Reich, who's now, back then it was at the Abraham Institute, now it's in Altos lab, which is also one of these kind of companies working on therapeutics for aging. And there I also met another PhD student back then, Tom Stapps, which I think you know.
Tom, yeah.
Who's
Hi,
now
Tom.
Also one of the founders and the CEO at Hurdle. And we were both really, you know, interested in these technologies, but more importantly, you know, we were seeing that there was a clear lack of translation of a lot of these technologies, right? So a lot of this was hidden in academic labs, and there was really the need of, like, you know, taking these amazing technologies and making them more accessible. So, you know, we were very, like, well positioned, I guess, to do it, given that we were doing, you know, developing new epigenetic technologies, and, you know, we decided to take the leap. So we, Tom also knew the other founders, so Charles, Toby, and Rob. And then, yeah, we decided to start with this journey. As you said, first we founded Chronomics, then we rebranded it to Hurdle. But really the mission was around, you know, making diagnostics, you know, more accessible and more actionable anywhere, anytime, and for anyone, right? And as I'm sure you share that passion, you know, there's really a need to improve the access to these diagnostics, you know, how clunky some of the diagnostic pathways are, et cetera. So, you know, we're building infrastructure that allows to launch novel types of biomarkers and diagnostics a lot faster for organizations. So rather than having to worry about all the complexity behind the scenes, we're able to support these organizations to launch very complex tests, like, you know, an epigenetic test or a genetic test, but also kind of more, you know, common tests out there that require scaling, like a cholesterol test or a urine test or some other things.
Okay. And so, like, going way back to the beginning, like, what was it like? Did you have a business background at all, or were you just an academic? And, like, what was that kind of change like for you?
Yeah, so I was an academic. I still very much enjoy research. So I think, you know, I've picked up a lot of the business skills on the go, as, you know, you have to do as a startup founder. But my big passion is very much still research and, you know, innovation and, you know, coming up with new products and innovation and bringing them to market, right? And yeah, I have to pick a lot of skills, you know, as we go, as you know, like, you know, with fundraising, with, you know, getting out there and selling our proposition. But to me, it's been, you know, it's been a fantastic journey because it really, you know, puts in perspective a lot of the research that you're doing. And, you know, sometimes when you're just focused on your research, you forget about the kind of bigger picture, about what really moves the needle, about the things that really matter and that, like, really translate for patients. And I think being, you know, having this kind of hybrid setup where, you know, we can still do research and discover new things, but at the same time, the ability to translate a lot of those diagnostics through our platform to the real world is very exciting.
I think that's really interesting. So it sounds like, but correct me if I'm wrong, where you started where was to sort of with this insight, which said, at the moment, there's this incredible depth of really exciting novel biomarkers that tell us incredible things that we've not really been able to calculate or diagnose before, but they exist solely in research laboratories for technology reasons, legacy reasons, cost reasons, access reasons. And you decided to try and build a platform that made them, like, you know, 100 or 1,000 times more accessible, you know, for 100 or 1,000 times lower price. Is that kind of the?
That's correct. Yeah. And there's still a lot of work to do. I mean, when, you know, we obviously have improved a lot since the days when we founded, right? And, you know, we've done now, I think, more than, you know, 3 million tests. We have like more than 280 different things that we can offer. So, you know, there's a lot of progress in that translation. But I think a stat that is really shocking to me still is that if you look at the number of, you know, papers that have been published on biomarker discovery, for example, and how many of those actually make it to the clinic after regulations and everything, is less than 1%, like a lot less than 1%. So there's a massive amount of knowledge, a massive amount of biomarkers out there that haven't made haven't seen, you know, patients yet.
Back the truck up a second for it. Hold on. So, of all research done into biomarker discovery, so that what that means, again, correct me if I'm wrong, that means basically finding new things to test for. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Finding new biomarkers for diseases or conditions or monitoring of specific things or, you know, recommending a specific drugs. There are a lot of, applications. But of all that research that's been done in a lot of academic labs and institutions, less than 1% has seen like a regulated diagnostic in market. So there's still so much work to do to take, you know, not only to do more research, which we also still need to keep doing, right? But to take a lot of those discoveries and a lot of, you know, those biomarkers that are sitting and technologies that are sitting in, you know, amazing centers around the world and like make them reach patients. And I think, you know, with Herdo, we're in a mission to try to accelerate that process as well.
That's insane. I mean, I know I've heard about like this kind of, I don't know what you call it, but sort of the issues, if you like, around academic research and the huge drop off into the real world, you know, or like that kind of valley of death or whatever you want to call it, of sort of translational, the translation of academic, successful academic work into real world. Is that because there's something inherently really hard about new biomarkers and then actually productizing them into something that can be effectively sold safely past regulation? You know, is that actually really quite hard for novel biomarkers?
So I'll tell you what, I don't think the main limitations to make biomarkers and diagnostics accessible are scientific limitations or technological limitations. I think the main limitations are funding limitations and regulatory limitations. So those are the two of the biggest bottlenecks. If you actually look at, like, if you try to predict which biomarkers will become successful farther down the line, I can bet you that you can be a lot more accurate than if you try to predict if a drug candidate is going to make it at the end of the you know, process, because a lot of the signatures are pretty robust, right? And you may need to work on, you know, developing them or like deploying it in easier assays. Maybe sometimes some of them will fail. But I think the biggest challenges are, you know, as I said, funding. So investors, you know, normally put a lot more emphasis on therapeutics rather than in diagnostics. And I think there's still a lot of work to probably have seen to shift that mindset, right? And move a lot of the investment to diagnostics as well, because ultimately, if we want to prevent, we need to detect. And if we need to detect, we need diagnostics. And then I think the second side of things is regulatory. So even though, you know, regulatory bodies are doing a great job, but like, for example, now with new AI regulation, et cetera, to keep up to date, you know, it's still fairly slow to, you know, bring a new diagnostic to market. And, you know,
does it have to, if you try and diagnose, because presumably a lot of this epigenetic, let's just deal with epigenetic, genetic stuff for a second. I'm assuming it's all being run for the most part in laboratories with relatively large pieces of laboratory equipment, right? Is that
That's correct. Right.
So how is that regulated? Is that regulated as a device in and of itself, or is it regulated as a test that runs on someone else's device? Like, what's that pathway?
Yeah, so it all depends on the intended use case of the device that you're bringing to market, right? So For example, a lot of the epigenetic tests that Hurdle and other companies offer as well on biological age, they're considered wellness tests. So they
Okay.
don't have a diagnostic claim on them. So you're given a number that is kind of an holistic measurement of your health status, and then you're given sometimes certain recommendations around lifestyle, diet, etc., which again are considered within the wellness space of regulation. So they don't need a CE mark, they don't need a UK CE mark. They're not considered in the kind of core definition on IVD, but there are other types of epigenetic diagnostics. For example, some of the new, early detection multi-cancer detection tests, those would be, for example, to, diagnose or at least a pre-diagnosis of, different types of cancer. So in that case, you will need to go through regulations. You will need to like do the studies and generate the analytical and clinical evidence that you require to basically go through regulatory processes.
And that can be many years. I mean, particularly if you need to do multi-stage clinical trials.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. Yeah. It's going to be many years, and it's you need to plug it into an infrastructure, right? You need to work with hospitals, you need to work many times with,
you need to find the patients, right?
You need to find the patients.
If you're trying to detect cancer markers, you need cancer patients of the particular stage where you're trying to detect that marker. That's going to get really complicated.
Yeah, and particularly with those type of tests that are like normally prospective studies, it's even like more difficult, right? So yeah, there are a few hurdles there, but we are working towards building infrastructure that allows to remove some of those, and hopefully over time we'll facilitate a lot of this discoveries that are being made to reach patients a lot faster than what we currently do.
Makes sense. And how you mentioned it a second ago, I think, which is what's your view on this like chicken and egg concept between, is it the therapeutic that drives the need for the diagnostic, or is it the diagnostic that creates the market for the therapeutic?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, we're going to need both, right? And I know that's kind of
the easy
way out of the conversation. Yeah. But to me, I think I think pretty much everyone now is convinced that preventative healthcare is the way forward, and precision medicine as well. So you are going to need diagnostics in preventative healthcare. You're going to need ways to detect as early as possible all the different diseases that we have a huge burden in our societies. So there you need diagnostics. And I think that's what I was trying to say before. We need them before the therapeutic. Ideally, we never need to get to the point where we need a therapeutic, right? That is the most efficient way of doing this. Obviously, that's not going to be the case. We will still need the therapeutics. And I think, once we need the therapeutic, I think what we need from the diagnostic side, and this is something that, we discuss a lot with the pharma and biotech companies that we work with, when you are developing a new therapeutic, you are developing it for a particular population, right? And you need to be able to stratify those populations in the right way so then clinical trials don't fail. One of the reasons why a lot of clinical trials fail is because we are giving a drug to a very heterogeneous population, and then only a subset of that population will react to the drug. And sometimes we say the drug isn't effective, but actually is effective in one of those populations.
You just got the patient cohort wrong that you were testing it on.
Exactly. So we need, we need diagnostics and biomarkers that, in that space are called companion diagnostics that allow to both, stratify the population where therapeutics work, and also to monitor, and allow for the dosing, et cetera, of the therapeutics moving forward. So those both diagnostic and therapeutic, I would like to see a lot more biotech and pharma companies, developing both of them together. Because there's more than enough data to show that is a more effective strategy to get it into the market.
I would find it hard to believe that anyone's going to be able to build a drug without a way to test the impact of that drug on the biomarker that it's targeting, basically.
Yeah, I guess the question is like how deep you go into that, right? Like, are you going to measure kind of traditional biomarkers, or are you going to try to measure other things that before we didn't have visibility on, right? So you can discover novel signatures of disease.
Interesting. And those novel signatures of those things might also unlock other therapeutics that could target those particular things themselves in some way, shape or form.
Exactly. Yeah. There's always going to be, beyond the kind of diagnostic that you get at the end of it, you will generate a lot of data that will help you, to develop future drugs more effectively.
It's fascinating. So just to kind of go back to the bit about when you were starting the company, what were the things that surprised you about running a company that you didn't like, that you were like, oh God, I didn't know it would be like that. Oh, I didn't know that that would happen. What were some of those things? As a scientist moving across, I always ask this of any sort of clinical, technical person that's moved over into starting a company.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I was surprised, but also I think that PhD equips you well for this, like the level of resilience that you need to go through the journey, right? So it's a roller coaster, as I'm sure any founder knows. You know, you need to be continuously pushing for it, fighting for it, you know, convincing people that this is the way forward. And I think, you know, many people underestimate at the beginning of the journey what this entails and how important that is. And I think another thing that surprised me is, again, how many of the hurdles that you have to translate some of these things are not necessarily kind of scientific or technological hurdles, but, you know, regulatory or, you know, just lack of adoption or just finding the right people to take this technology. So I think those were big learnings for me.
And do you feel like, to go back to the point that you made earlier around the things that are holding or arguably potentially holding back this translation of research into real world application, is around support for clinical, technical, scientific individuals that could potentially start a business, but just aren't quite sure. And so they stay in academia and their research remains academic.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think there needs to be a lot more. There's so much potential, you know, in UK centers, but also worldwide, of translating a lot more of the research. And I think, as I said, I think scientists are very well equipped with, you know, and clinicians as well, to, you know, with the type of training that they had to make that leap. And I think we need to, yeah, provide the right bridges and the right, you know, things in place in the system to encourage this, to allow for this. And yeah, I've been, you know, when I speak back with like some of the students that were in my institute, or, you know, I always encourage people that, like, you know, I didn't think originally about this as like, this is what I want to do, but I had the opportunity, I jump into it, and it's been very fulfilling. So I think there's a lot about also hearing those stories, and, you know, encouraging people to make that leap, as you said.
And have you, you know, because obviously you're Spanish by birth, I believe. Have you, not just in Spain, but in other countries, have you seen any other country do it better, that translation piece, than the UK? And if so, what do you think we could learn?
Yeah, it's always difficult to, I guess, compare countries. I would say, you know, in Spain, there's been a lot of progress since I was there. I think there's been a lot more emphasis on entrepreneurship, and, like, you know, you have growing startup communities, you know, in some of the hubs starting to happen. There's still a lot of work to do, but I think it's you know, trending in the right direction. I think the UK, as much as sometimes we say, okay, you know, there's still things to improve, the NHS, etc. But in reality, I think the UK does a really good job in terms of translating, you know, health tech innovation. And obviously there's still a lot of work to do, but I think, again, it's in the DNA of the country to, you know, keep innovating and hopefully bringing a lot of these things that the NHS needs so much to clinical practice.
Yeah, I think that's the one. I'm going to say one thing and then we'll go for a break. I think that's the one sometimes unheralded benefit of having a national healthcare system, is that the cost and the benefit are all in the same place.
Exactly, yeah.
Which is not the case in many, many, many other countries. So actually, it I agree with you. There's 1,000 things, maybe more, that need to get fixed. But that system and whoever is in charge of the country has the ability and accrues the benefit of thinking very long term.
Yeah.
Which isn't always the case in other countries.
Exactly. Yeah. That's completely true. And I think, I mean, I'm a big defender of, like, you know, public health systems as the way forward. And I think you summarize there really, really well one of the big benefits of it, right? That ultimately by design is gonna optimize for value-based care. And I think that's, you know, that's something that I think we're very lucky to have in Europe.
Great. I agree with you. Right. Last break coming up, and then we've got the last bit of the show. So thank you very much for everyone. You've got 2 more minutes of commercials, and then it's back again for the last part of this week's show with me, Steve Roost, and my guest, Danny Martin-Herance from Hurdle. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the final part of this week's show with me, Steve Roost, CEO of PocDoc and host of the Health Tech Hour, and my guest, Danny Martin-Herance, who is the Chief Scientific Officer and co-founder of Hurdle, as well as being an expert and a thought leader in the epigenetic longevity space. So, last part of the show, Danny, a couple of things I want to cover off. In the last part of the show, you mentioned that your journey, you found your journey as a founder particularly fulfilling. I think you used the word fulfilling, or you got a lot of fulfillment from it. What are the things that you've personally got fulfillment from?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think in terms of the, probably the ability, as we said, to translate a lot of, you know, the research that I was doing before and like, you know, see the first users and like then, you know, millions of users like using, you know, the types of technologies that you've brought forward. I think that's incredibly fulfilling for me because I've always, I guess, had that kind of, you know, like voice in my head, I guess, telling me, hey, you need to help, you know, you need to have an impact. And, you know, it's not only about you having fun doing science, it's also about, you know, benefiting patients. And I think I've always been very passionate about supporting with health. I don't think I could have been a doctor. I think I have incredible respect for the people that are in the front line all the time, but I don't think I could have done it. But this was my kind of way of saying, okay, I'm contributing to that. So I think that is a great part of the fulfillment. And I think the other part is probably the journey with the people, right? So I think the, you know, just I'm a very social person, I guess. I like to, you know, exchange ideas. I like to, you know, work in teams and, you know, just the ability to grow from an idea to, you know, a company with, you know, people that, you know, come into the journey with you, want to push forwards that vision. I think that's incredibly fulfilling. And, you know, one interesting story is that we grew a lot during COVID times and we grew a lot remote, right? We haven't seen each other in person. So, you know, one of the kind of very happy memories that I have is like when we could finally, you know, meet together in the same room and we had some dinner, suddenly, you know, seeing everyone that you had been working for, you know, tirelessly for months and just all in the same room. And, you know, it felt really real, right? Like going from like a very small team to like a pretty big team. So I, you know, that sort of like feeling also drives me of like, you know, just working with people and driving something together forwards. So those are probably the two most fulfilling things for me.
I would agree with you, particularly on the last, well, on all of them, but the that moment after COVID where everyone could come back together again, I think was really special for a lot of people, me included, you know, and fingers crossed we won't have to go back to that anytime soon, because that was it seems like a long time ago. So the other thing that you mentioned was that you felt like the PhD had set you up pretty well to start the company, the mentality. So outside of the PhD or outside of what you learned during your PhD, what were the key kind of learnings that you got or have gotten from starting the company that you didn't get from your scientific background? Like whether it's behaviors or attitudinal or hard knowledge, like what's come purely from the business bit?
Yeah, obviously, I mean, there's a lot of like skills, knowledge, et cetera, that I had to pick up, right? From, you know, managerial skills to just, you know, an understanding of a business, how it operates and like what is important, what's not, what's revenue, what's, you know, all these things, cash flows, you know. I think the, you know, the things that more, I guess, on the, I don't know how to call it, but like more on the kind of, I don't like too much the term transferable skills, but like more like human skills, you know, I think you go from, you know, a vision where you're like really focused on something very specific. Yes, you work in, you know, with some people, collaborate with some people, but you have, you know, when you're doing research, a lot of it is like, I want to have an impact. I want, you know, my research to like move the needle. I want, and I think what, you know, you learn a lot once you start a business is that it's no longer about you. It's like the team right. that you have, it's the people that you work with. It's like, it's impossible to do anything just by yourself. And I think that for me was very empowering, like that idea of moving away from, I need to be the one doing it to, you know, I want to be a catalyzer of, you know, a team doing this, or, you know, a company doing this, or hopefully one day a society doing this. I think that is, you know, that to me was also very, like, a big learning, and, you know, a very, again, not to use the same terminology, but like fulfilling kind of thing to pick up.
I agree with you on that bit. There comes a point where, you know, it's no longer you and the founders and your co-founders, and you have to build a team of people and continually build that team to be able to reach the next stage and the next stage and the next stage, and being able to have trust in that team to execute on things and to deliver the vision really just is the only thing that's going to leverage your time. And it's the only thing that you realize can actually scale the business. And I've seen lots of people who can't make that leap. You know, they can't let go, and they're sort of constrained by their own, you know, the physical limitations of only being able to work so many hours in a day, or, you know, needing to sleep 8 hours a night or whatever it is you need to sleep. So I completely agree with you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, I mean, that's probably something that, like, you know, as you said, like, successful founders see, right? Like, you need to make that leap. You need to let the thing almost self-organize with, you know, their original vision. And, you know, many times you're surprised by what emerges from it, and, like, you know, what people can come up with and how people can innovate. And I think this is incredibly fascinating and interesting to see coming to life.
Yeah, I heard one of my favorite anecdotes at the moment is the Amazon methodology. And I haven't verified this. I was told this, so I haven't completely, like, fact checked this before people yell at me. But apparently in Amazon, for a long time, if you're starting a new project, the first thing that you do in the first meeting, the first thing you do is the only question that they ask is, if we had unlimited capital, what would we do? That's how you start the project. And then you work out what that would look like if you had unlimited capital. Then the next question is, well, if you had, for example, 10 million pounds, what would it look like? And then you sort of start to work it backwards from there, but you have a very consistent idea of where your ultimate, true, pure vision would be. And then you work it back to the reality.
Yeah, no, I think that's incredibly helpful, because you want to dream big when you start thinking about solving problems, right? You don't want to be constrained by kind of limitations. And then, as you said, then you need to bring it back to reality. I think I'm not 100% sure, but also I think what Amazon does as well is, you know, they think about press releases. So they write the project in the form of a press release as well to see what would be the final kind of outcome of what this would look like, right? Because sometimes, you know, and that is like part of this kind of user-centric mentality that is in Amazon as well. And I think it should be really in any company. That, you know, you want to be thinking about your patients, your users, and then also working backwards from there, right? You don't want to come up with something that sounds super fancy that then actually is useless in that context.
That's a great, I didn't know they did that. That's a good one too. I might steal that one as well. So before we go, we've got last few minutes of the show. I'd love you to paint a picture, and you can include Hurdle in this and how you guys are driving towards this vision. But what's the 5 year, 10 year, 50 year vision in around this longevity space and novel biomarkers, novel therapeutics? Like, where do you see this, like, going in the near future, slightly extended, and goodness knows who knows?
Yeah. I think, I mean, for me, I'll tackle this from the diagnostics perspective, because I think in longevity, there's a lot of, you know, interesting thing happening. And anyway, nothing in longevity aging can happen without biomarkers. This is one, like, when you go to, you know, longevity conferences, et cetera, it's like, right, we're all trying to tackle aging or the hallmarks of aging. But if you're not able to measure that accurately, then you're not going to know if the drugs are working. So when you actually go to these conferences, 80% or 70% still about biomarkers of aging, diagnostics, how do we know that we're quantifying this? Because we cannot make clinical trials that, you know, last decades, because that's just not doable. So, but if we kind of limit it to the kind of diagnostic side of things and biomarker side of things, I mean, to me, the next step, how we see it, and I hope other people also see it as well, is, you know, moving towards what we're calling personalized diagnostic journeys. So at the moment, we are giving very similar diagnostic journeys to everyone that are normally clunky, both from, I guess, how the tests are being done or how you access them, et cetera, but also from a data and like prediction perspective, right? So I'll give you a personal example because I think this illustrates it. You know, I obviously test a lot of tests. I did one for a polygenic risk score calculation across many diseases, and I came up with polygenic risk score, so like a genetic test that basically, you know, checks like for the risk of like a lot of different diseases. And, you know, I got a higher, like quite high risk of like prostate cancer. And what that means for me is that now I should be starting to test for PSA since I'm 40 rather than when I'm 50, which is the kind of average recommendation for the population, right? So what that means is that I don't have the same diagnostic journey as someone else that doesn't have that risk. And the health system should know that, and the health system should give me the right kind of steps on that. So, you know, doing this with any diagnostic pathway, you know, for anyone is not an easy thing to solve. So, but it's the problem that needs to be solved in diagnostics besides having the actual diagnostics accessible. So we're doing a lot of work on how we can build those personalized diagnostic journeys. You know, we're doing different things, obviously, with machine learning AI as well to, you know, advance in that front. And I think there will be a lot more people that start to try to solve that problem of what is the best next, you know, measurement that I can do from you to both help you to prevent disease, but also build a health profile that in the future is kind of bulletproof to make the right decisions and do this in a way that is safe, that it's a good experience and reduces the cost for the healthcare system as much as possible. So it's a very big problem, but I think that's, you know, a great part of like what we're going to have to solve. And obviously, as I said, I think, you know, one of the big trends is machine learning AI. Obviously, I do think sometimes this is overstated. And
what? Come on, Danny. What? Overstated?
What are you saying? Yeah.
What?
Exactly. But I do think there is some of these technologies are going to come in helpful, you know, for certain tasks. So, you know, in things like multimodal integration of data or, you know, being able to build copilots for doctors for like complex diagnostic challenges, etc. So I think, you know, it will be possible to build those kind of personalized diagnostic journeys. And I think eventually the final step of this will be precision medicine, right? Where, you know, we have the right data that we need for the right person, and we will be able to make informed treatment decisions in a better way. So to me, that's kind of the next 5-10 years is going to be a steel focus on that.
That was a really fantastic way to wrap up the show. So we've got about a minute and a half. Last word, Danny. If any scientists are listening to this, what would your advice be to them about starting their own company or not? Very quickly.
Just do it. That's it.
That's a great, yeah, that's a good way to end the show. All right, Danny. Danny Martin-Herrans, Chief Scientific Officer from Hurdle. Thank you very much for coming on the show. If people want to find out more about Hurdle, where do they go?
So they can go to hurdle.bio, and then we are also in like all the social media. So yeah, check it out.
Great. Perfect. Thank you very much to everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week with
thanks for having me, Steve.
Thank you.